Thank you, Ruth. I have a friend in the European Parliament, a Polish MEP, who was supposed to have been on the flight that crashed outside Smolensk, killing the President of the Republic and the entire leadership of Poland. And at the last minute, he had given up his place on that aircraft to a member of his staff. There were two ways of getting to the commemoration. One was a much longer train journey, the other was the shorter flight, and he had said to somebody in his office, look, don't worry, you can have my seat on the plane, I'll take the slow route, then you can have the weekend at home with your kids. You can imagine how he was feeling when the news came through of what had happened. And we spoke late into the night, and he started telling me about his life, and in particular, the impact on him as a teenager growing up in Warsaw when Pope John Paul II came as the first Polish pope and, of course, as the first pope to visit a communist country. And he was telling me about how that had energized and elevated the political aspirations of his entire generation. And he told me something I'd never heard before. He said, you know, in the whole of that visit, the Holy Father never once directly criticized the communist authorities. He said he didn't have to, because he was offering something better. And that, surely, my friends, should be our watchword and our creed as we go into this referendum. I could stand here and harangue you for the next 10 minutes about the atrocities and abominations in Brussels, about the fraud and the waste and the expense, the swatting aside of referendums and all the rest of it. You'd nod along vigorously, and at the end, not one of you would feel any better. There is a lesson for us all in the recent referendum which Brian was just talking about. Against all the odds, the nationalist side in that referendum went from a 20-point deficit to a 10-point deficit. All conventional theory is that there's a swing to the status quo option during the campaign. In Scotland, it didn't happen. Why didn't it happen? Because Alex Salmond was relentlessly cheerful. And the unionist campaign, foolishly, was conversely negative. Oh, what will happen to the currency? Oh, what will happen to the EU? Oh, will all these companies disinvest? There is a bloody-minded streak in all English peoples, all English-speaking peoples, and I think perhaps especially among Scots, that says, don't tell me what I bloody well can't do. And Salmond dealt with all of those objections by swallowing them up in a supernova of good cheer and optimism. Yeah, we'll have problems, but they'll be our problems as an independent people. We need to carry our countrymen with a vision of a prosperous, independent, global Britain, interested and engaged in the affairs of every continent, including Europe. There is no purpose in reflecting people's grievances back at them. Of course, people have concerns about migration. Of course, they have concerns about money and all the rest of it. But it's not enough just to tell people what they're already unhappy about. You have to show that you have a better plan. So let's spend the limited amount of time when we've captured people's attentions explaining the things that can be better. I see that the next speaker is going to talk about healthcare and NHS issues. This country was the world leader in clinical trials. We have 1% of the world's population. We had 12% of clinical trials in the UK until the EU's Clinical Trials Directive came into effect. Now we're down to about 1% again. That is an immediate, direct consequence of our membership. And outside, we could release the innovative genius that has always characterized our people. Outside the EU's rules on data protection and retention, Hoxton could be the Silicon Valley of this part of the world, designing software. If we didn't have ludicrous EU rules on protectionism, we could be importing those very cheap Chinese solar panels, so much so that they would be integrated into our vehicles and our buildings to the extent that we'd barely notice them. And as energy became cheaper, that would give a competitive lift to the entire economy. Our older industries would benefit too. Our farmers would be free to compete on quality with the world instead of being consigned to this life of form-filling, which has replaced the turning of the seasons. Our fish stocks would again be the great renewable resource that they once were. And this city would be able to triumph without the threat of malevolent regulations like the AIFMD, MiFID II, the bonus caps, the short selling ban, and all the rest of the array of Brussels regulations that are aimed expressly at trying to contain what they regard as a kind of freebooting capitalist model that lives off the sweat of the workers. Not that London would be the only city that recovered. As the common external tariff was dismantled, as we were able to import things more cheaply, I think we would see a great revival of our ports, particularly Liverpool and Glasgow, which found themselves effectively on the wrong side of the country in the 1970s when the common external tariff was introduced and when our trade was artificially redirected away from our natural hinterland and towards the European Union. And as goods become cheaper, the whole economy becomes more competitive and productivity gets a lift for everybody. We need also to talk about the microeconomic advantages to people. For most families in this country, if you tot up your budget and you look at where you're spending money, the top three items for most households in Britain are food bills, fuel bills, and taxes. Now, of course, people recognize one and two much more than they recognize three, because taxes are dispersed and hidden. Milton Friedman always used to complain about the pay-as-you-earn system that he'd played some role in designing. He said it was the worst thing he'd ever come up with because people were no longer aware of quite how much they were paying. But if you tot up the taxes, that is the single biggest item, certainly for every working household in the country. Now, I think we can show with quantifiable, empirical data how food bills and fuel bills and taxes will all be lower. None of this kind of vague waffle about, oh, maybe an overall lift to the economy might result in X or Y £1,000. We can show how much cheaper it would be to buy food at world prices rather than from the EU. We would, by the way, also be doing an immense favour to producers in Africa and other developing countries, instead of maintaining these amoral tariffs, while still protecting our own farmers with direct grants. I agree with what Ian Paisley said about that earlier. There'd be no reason to change their guarantee of income. We could also give a huge lift to every consumer. Fuel bills. Well, of course, energy prices will be cheaper once we are outside those Brussels boondoggles that masquerade as being about alternative energy and climate change, but are in fact extractive policies designed to take money from low and medium income households and hand it to a small group of people who are lucky enough to own large chunks of our land surface area. And taxes, well, that's the most easily quantified of all. Gross contribution of £19 billion to the EU last year. £350 million a week. To put that in context, if we withheld that contribution, we could give the entire country a two-thirds cut in their council tax. And here's the really good news. When you put that much more money in people's pockets, the whole economy begins to revive. You're in a positive feedback loop. It's a virtuous circle. We will all continue to benefit once those advantages start to flow. That's how we should be filling our time between now and polling day. I don't want to talk to you about migration and about Brussels bureaucrats and about corruption and so on. I mean, it would be terribly colourful. But you know what? People have already clocked that. They know that. They don't need us to adumbrate the link in detail. In the limited amount of bandwidth that we've got, sell a positive message. Let me close with a positive quotation along the lines of a positive message. I was in the Vote Leave office yesterday, and Steve Baker, the Conservatives for Britain chairman who you heard from earlier, inspired the staff by reading one of Wilfred Owen's war poems exactly 100 years ago. Well, there's a lovely line, not by Wilfred Owen, but by his contemporary Siegfried Sassoon, old boy of my school, as it happens, one of 749 Old Morburians who died in the First World War. And in a poem which takes the form of a letter to Robert Graves, there's a lovely line, "For I know dreams will triumph, though the dark scowls above me where I go." And this was a poem inspired by his seeing a flare in no man's land and looking up from the hellishness of the trenches and being inspired by that moment of illumination. Think of how our country has advanced in the intervening 100 years. Think of the transformative change that technology has brought. The improvement in longevity, in literacy, in infant mortality. The way in which we are living lives that are longer and happier and more fulfilled than our great-grandparents would have imagined possible. Governments didn't do that. Politicians didn't bring about those changes, and bureaucrats certainly had nothing to do with it. Those were the changes that come about when the genius of a free people is left to do its work. And our work now, in advance of this referendum, is again to unleash that potential, to move the rocks to one side and let the grass grow. For I know dreams will triumph.